Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. This hour, we'll take your phone calls with John Hughes Wilson. I do want to talk with him about his book, JFK, An American Coup d'Etat. We'll get into that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. John Hughes Wilson with us, his book, The Secret State, but also JFK, An American Coup d'Etat. Tell me what got you interested in the JFK assassination, John.
Well, it's a fairly straightforward story. I actually blundered into it through Marilyn Monroe. Someone asked me to do some work on Marilyn Monroe, and I thought this is very fishy. And the more I probed, the more I came to the conclusion that it was like a big intelligence jigsaw. And then I started on JFK, and eventually my agent dragged me into an American publisher, and they gave me what I can only describe as a viva voce for a PhD. Around the table, went on for about 2 hours, and they said, right, we'll commission this book. So I'm setting off to write this, and one of the bits of the jigsaw I picked up along the way was the KGB report on the assassination, which is fairly dramatic. And the irony of it all is when I'd written the book, I gave it to the publisher, and they said, we're not going to publish it. And I said, what?
Did they already give you some advance?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
2 years of my life wasted. What do you mean you're not? And they said, oh, no, and they blew smoke in my face and came up with all kinds of strange things. So the doctor might sue, the doctor who did the autopsy. I said, he can't sue. He's on the American Congressional Committee 3 times under oath. He's admitted he burnt the autopsy report. Yeah, well, we can't publish that. And it was all very strange, smoke and mirrors. And eventually they said, well, we're not going to publish it, so that's that. Can we have our advance back?
Oh, they wanted it back.
And my agent, who at the time was a little lady who never, ever said anything wrong at all, ever, she looked down the table and fixed this queen bee of the publishing house with a glassy eye and gave her a very short, sharp answer, I think, George, involving sex and travel.
Good. I'm glad you can't repeat that.
Oh, I've no idea what you're talking about, sir. Anyway, I then went to another publisher who publishes crime. And he looked at it. He said, yeah, this is a bestseller. We've got to publish it. So they published
Good
it eventually, and it's out in the States. But I was absolutely convinced after 2 years of work, and particularly looking at the KGB report, that in Richard Nixon's words, the Warren report was the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
That's true. That is true. There's no doubt about that. You know, the research I've done, John, it leads me into these areas. That one, a lot of people wanted Kennedy out of the way.
Absolutely right.
And so, you know, I'm going to say the mob, because there's some mobsters that desperately wanted him gone. They wanted also Bobby gone.
Yep.
There was this debacle in Cuba where, you know, they were trying to kill Castro a zillion times and they couldn't pull that off. So those people were angry that they couldn't pull it off, and they're blaming JFK. Lyndon Johnson's name had come up, though I don't think he was part of anything. I think he just may have heard some things, but I don't think he was intricately involved in it. But I think it was a combination of the CIA and the mob that got him.
Well, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And you've got it in one. I mean, one of the things that amazed me was Kennedy. Kennedy is a very astute politician. A very astute one. He puts together this extraordinary coalition. The problem is it's a coalition of his enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who can get the Cuban exiles, the CIA, the Pentagon, J. Edgar Hoover, the Mafia, the Texas oil barons, Wall Street, the South Vietnamese, the Israeli government, and lots of American influential Americans there, and his own vice president, all saying Kennedy's got to go, that's a remarkable constituency to put together. And in the end, it's Carlos Marcello, who in those days down in Louisiana.
And Trafficante.
He's the mafia capo de capo down in Louisiana. And he knows the contract's been taken out on Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general, because he's been talking out of both sides of his mouth. And the mafia feel cheated, not unreasonably, actually. And he then says, when they're taking the contract out on Bobby Kennedy, remember the old Sicilian proverb, if you want to really want to stop the dog's tail wagging, you cut the head off the goddamn dog. And that's why Carlos Marcello's godfather's contract is shifted to Kennedy.
And Trafficante was involved too, his buddy, right?
That's right. The Chicago mob's involved, but the main people is this unholy coalition between the disgruntled Cuban exiles after the debacle of the Bay of Pigs, the CIA being given a brief to try and kill Castro, for which they have to go and get the help of the mob. Why? Because before Batista's kicked out, where was the Las Vegas of America in those days? It was Cuba.
It was Cuba.
Everyone went to Cuba for their drugs, for their sex, and the gambling and all that.
Everything.
Kind of stuff.
It was closer to most people than Vegas was at the time.
Correct. And once they're kicked out, once the mob's kicked out, they're the people who have the expertise and the contacts. So the CIA, full of disgruntled people because Kennedy's threatened to break them up after the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban exiles and the mafia are all working to kill Castro.
Yeah.
In the middle of that, they decide that they'll take out Kennedy.
Where does Oswald, in your theory, fit in?
Well, I mean, the evidence...
Is he the patsy that he said he was?
A patsy. He's no doubt he's a patsy. There's no gunshot residue on him when he's taken into the police. Some of the photographs are obviously faked. The rifles don't match up. There's a whole string of things.
And he wasn't a good marksman.
No, he was rotten. And the finest sniper in the United States Marine Corps tried to replicate those three shots, I think, in, is it 6 seconds or something?
Mm-hmm.
With a Carcano, a Manlica Carcano, with that extraordinary top bolt, which is very hard to work. You have to come out of your aim, you have to re-cock it, go back into the aim. You can't get three shots at a moving target from one rifle. Impossible.
I had heard that they imported some people from Europe to help kill him.
Well, there are three very strange people who come in, and they're documented in the Texas Rangers. They're the state troopers down in Texas, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're documented coming in and going out. But the people I think really did it, and we've got confessions, are the trigger man for the Chicago Mafia, who's a guy called Nicoletti. And the other one is a guy who died in prison, and he's quite openly confessed to it, Jim Files. And he actually claims that he used the rifle, which is a fireball .222 weapon, and he crimps it with his teeth, and there's a wealth of evidence. And if you actually look at Kennedy's autopsy report, the entry hole is front right of the skull. The exit hole is the back left, and the back of his head's blown off. And poor old Jackie Kennedy's trying to get off of the back of the car, a bit of skull.
In your opinion, John, why did they whitewash the Warren report? What were they trying to hide? The involvement of trying to kill Castro? There was a reason they didn't want us to know.
Well, I don't know is the straight answer to a straight question. Not my guess. The probability is the Kennedy brothers had before that been planning a coup in Cuba. The still great secrecy surrounds that, and it's a very dangerous business. Both the Kennedy brothers were plotting a coup in Cuba, that Castro would be assassinated and America would move in and take over.
Even after they agreed with Khrushchev that they wouldn't go into Cuba after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Correct, and yeah. That's one of the reasons why they had to keep it so deathly secret. And if you actually go into this in detail, the key to the Kennedy and the White House involvement is this secret coup in Cuba. Now, there's tons of evidence on that, and it was all due to start on the 1st of December. When's Kennedy killed? The week before.
The week before. That's right. And they tried in Tampa and Chicago.
That's right. They have a go in Chicago. That doesn't go at all well. That can be flanneled away. And then they're going to have a go in Tampa, and they actually have a patsy lined up there who's an ex-U.S. Marine. Just like Oswald,
mm-hmm. And
it all goes wrong, and they arrest him, and he says, no, it's nothing to do with me. But they finally get it right at Dallas.
They get it right at Dallas, exactly. Let's take some calls here. They're lining up for you, John. Let's go to Brian in Indianapolis, Indiana, to get the thing started east of the Rockies. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, George, right out of the gate, man. What an honor.
You got it.
Hey, listen, you need to bring your show to Indianapolis. I keep telling you.
I know. I'm talking to Tommy about that as you speak.
Hey, listen, I'm sitting here listening to all this, and I'm thinking, you know, Kennedy or Trump is kind of like Kennedy. A lot of people don't like him, you know, maybe not for the same kind of reasons, but what do you think a conspiracy that took out Kennedy could happen nowadays and take out Trump?
Well, let me answer that, because that is the one subject that I consider taboo to talk about, because I just don't want any more crazies to get any crazier ideas.
Correct.
So let's just leave that as it is, Brian. It's an interesting question, but I just have historically never gone there during those kinds of questions. So we'll not answer that at all. And let's go to Tom in La Jolla, California. Hey, Thomas, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. And John Hughes Wilson, it's a honor to speak with you, and I look forward to ordering both of your books. And my question, before Ian Fleming, who wrote about James Bond in fiction, there was another British insider, and 70 years ago, this British insider, Eric Blair, wrote under the pen name George Orwell. And 70 years ago, he wrote a very remarkable fictional work called 1984, and which was also made into a fabulous British movie 30 years ago with John Hurt, Richard Burton, and Susanna Hamilton, and directed by Michael Radford. But 1984 was very remarkable. It addressed the secret surveillance state. It addressed the uses of propaganda and the revision of history, the ongoing revision of history. And also, remarkably, for its time, 70 years ago, addressed the geopolitical triangle on planet Earth of the Anglo-American alliance versus Russia versus China. And George Orwell called it Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania. But I was wondering if you could speak about Eric Blair, George Orwell, a British insider, what he knew, and why his book still seems to be accurate today in terms of how, even though it's fictional. That's my question for you. And again, I look forward to ordering your books, sir.
And Orwell was way ahead of his time, John,
oh, yes.
Wasn't he?
George Orwell, who's, as you say, his real name is Eric Blair, he's an extraordinary character. He is actually a very left-wing socialist, and he's very disenchanted with the socialist world he sees going on, particularly Stalin's Russia, which he sees as a perversion of pure socialism. And that, of course, is why he wrote that wonderful book, Animal Farm, which is a satire on the Soviet Union. But for 1984, he's dying of tuberculosis. He's living in bomb-strewn, wrecked London after the war, and the Second World War not only bankrupted Britain, but it razed a lot of London to the ground in the Blitz. There was heavy rationing. Bread was still being rationed after the war in Britain. And he's describing, all is describing, effectively the London of 1946 to 1948, where, the rocket bombs coming in at the end of the war, the V2s, all those things are there. And he is remarkably perceptive, and he talks about the surveillance state. He talks about newspeak, the perversion of language, which we see around us all with political correctness at the moment. He talks about the revision and rewriting of history. That's what his job was, the hero of that. And he talks about this, as you quite rightly say, this huge geopolitical clash of endless war going on. And the reason it's called 1984 is really just an inversion of 1948. But he has produced one of the most, I think, powerful books of its time and ever since. And what's remarkable is we now, and this is the crunch, we've now reached 1984. You go to London today, there is a TV camera on every corner.
Yeah.
You can't even pick your nose in public, assuming you wanted to do such a thing.
Of course.
Without it being recorded. And worse, much worse, everything you say on your mobile phone and on the telephone can be monitored and recorded.
He was like the Leonardo da Vinci of his time.
Oh, what a good remark. That's a very clever analogy. Yes, it is. Yes, yes, I'd go along with that.
Died at 47 years old, too, John. Jeez.
Yeah, I'm going to use that. Thank you.
You can. It's all yours. Take it away. Give me a little attribution or the show. Yeah, but what the heck?
And a commission fee.
Hey, by the way, all your works, you're always invited back on this show, just so you know that.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Cyprus, we're going to come out and visit you one day. Let's go next to Jeff in Culver City, California. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, hi, George and Mr. Wilson. Yes, hi. I've always been intrigued and fascinated by the so-called signals intelligence apparatus. You know, to the untrained individual or regular layperson not familiar with what signals intelligence is or SIGNET is, you know, the activity is portrayed as an information gathering tool utilizing the various satellites, GPS coordinates, telephonic and radio signals, you know, for the most part. But I believe these signals coming from wherever source or whatever source is even greater than that, you know, and by this I mean these electronic signals hovering above our heads in the air can affect certain people in several different kind of ways. That is, their subconscious or sleep states of mind. My question is this, Mr. Wilson, do you believe that the signals intelligence is actually a clandestine way to enter into a person's subconscious or sleep state utilizing whatever technological means currently available, you know, and that is satellites, radio waves, telephonic waves, or whatever, and then they use that to glean any information derived from those selected individuals once awakened from that sleep state of mind? And I think you answer off the air.
Very interesting. People have a strange view about signals intelligence, and all it is really is, as its name implies, exploitation of the electromagnetic spectrum. And, of course, every time we talk about SIGINT, we talk about code-breaking and beautiful young naval officers, you know, female climbing up ladders and putting things in for U-boats. Of course, code-breaking and cipher is only a very small part of SIGINT. The first thing you get with SIGINT is you find the frequency of where people are. You get their location of the transmitter. Remember the old German phrase, transmission is treason. Every time you press the Pressel switch, you're giving away your location. And what you can do from that, of course, is you don't have to break codes to do traffic analysis. You can say this headquarters is talking to that subunit, and that subunit is moving there because the signal's moved. Now, as to the idea of being able to hoover up people's brain waves, the answer to that is, I don't think the scientists have got there yet, but I think the CIA have probably experimented in that direction without a lot of success.
You know, John, when you look at what's going on with this world technologically, do you think they're going to chip us all, put little chips in us?
Oh, we're there. We're there already. I can assure you, we now have a situation where chips are being put in Sweden, into people's wrist. I can't remember the actual name of the technology, but you put a chip into someone's wrist, and it's about the size of a grain of rice, and it allows them to open locked electronic doors. They can pay for stuff in the cafeteria. There is a Swedish company that's already doing this. And, of course, we're doing that in Europe and Britain with animals being chipped by vets so you can trace where little poodle's gone if it disappears. Now, I have heard, and I don't know if it's true, that there are companies in the United States that are offering to chip your baby.
Oh, in the foot or something like that. Hold on, John. We're at the break. We'll come back. We'll talk more and take final calls. And welcome back to Coast. John Hughes Wilson with us. This is our final segment with him. His latest book is called The Secret State. And, of course, we'll get to your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. John Hughes Wilson with us, and then we'll get to your calls as well. John, it's amazing all these things that have been happening, and we just keep rolling along as human beings, huh?
Well, it is, and I think one of the things I also do a newspaper column, and one of the things I'm writing on at the moment is we're living through a revolution. And I think we are living through a revolution at this moment, and it's quite extraordinary. We've got Trump in America, we've got the Brits pulling out of Europe, Brexit, we're living through a digital revolution that's as strong as the Industrial Revolution ever was. The world is breaking up in front of our eyes. We are living through historic times. But the problem for humanity is you still have to get up in the morning, earn a buck, take the kids to bed, make a meal. So it's very hard. What's that lovely American expression? It's hard to remember. You when you're up to your ass in alligators that you first came here to drain the swamp. But we're living through history.
Indeed we are. Let's go to call Stamford, Connecticut. Hello, Keith. Welcome to the show.
Hey, George and
John. Oh,
it's so great to call to speak to the colonel this evening. Your topic is wonderful. Just as an aside, you were talking about the chipping. I think we're already there with the chipping.
Mm-hmm.
You can't remove. I think my daughter's cell phone is surgically attached to her, so there's no need to chip.
That's right.
But I have one question regarding intelligence. It is said in our country that the intelligence agencies are not supposed to spy domestically on private citizens. Do they get around this by a little handshake agreement, like let's say with another country, say Britain, and say, hey, Britain, would you monitor, would you give us information on this individual, and we'll do the same for yours, and get around that that law that way? Does that happen?
Keith, absolutely. You've got it in one. It's called outsourcing in business, isn't it? And what they've done, and they've admitted this, but not very openly and perhaps the way they should, what happened is America has put a lot of effort into getting a contract with GCHQ here in Cheltenham to collect stuff on American citizens. And although I can't confirm this, the NSA is doubtless doing the same for British people. And because the links are so close, people talk about the special relationship, and journalists get it wrong every time. The real special relationship between Britain and America goes back to Churchill and Roosevelt, FDR, and it's about intelligence, and then later about nuclear. That's the core of the special relationship. And if you go to NSA, you'll find GCHQ officers there and vice versa. And we've outsourced it to each other. Now they've been caught with their hand in the cookie jar. I don't know where we are at the moment.
John, you were talking about babies getting their chips. You're right. Parents are being offered that now. But do you ever see the time where people will be compelled to have this done?
Oh, yes, I would think so. And I'm not being alarmist. I don't think it'll happen in a democracy, but I could see some totalitarian state like, for example, China, the anthill, where they're all forced to have what I call them passive integrated transponder, PIT. It's a PIT tag, it's called. They have one in the back of the neck put in there easily. All for your safety, sir. All for your security.
Yes, and convenience.
I think that's coming.
Yeah. Do you have in Britain, do they have, like we have here, social security numbers?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You have a national insurance number, and that goes with you for life.
Now, tell me about your national insurance program, because they're doing away with the Obamacare one. Desperately trying to, you know, do it with something. But how does yours work?
Well, ours worked originally. The National Health Service comes in after the Second World War, and the idea is very good. And everyone paid a national insurance contribution separately from your income tax, and the national insurance contribution paid for the National Health Service. Well, life being what it is and people being what it is, over the last 70, 80 years, it's evolved. We now have a situation where the demand on the National Health Service is so big, we could spend all our money on it,
yeah,
and we still wouldn't be able to afford it. The National Health Service in Britain is a good model, but it's now in crisis. And you've got a situation, and I'm going to bring you a personal thing here. I pay taxes still on my army pension and my estate old age pension, which I have to pay for the rest of my life. I am not entitled to medication when I go back to UK, even though I pay UK taxes. And that makes me very angry. But it shows the system is falling apart.
Oh, my God,
To use a good American expression, if I may, George, no taxation without medication.
That's so true. So true indeed. Next up, we go to Maui in Hawaii. Archer's with us. Hi, Archer. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi there.
George, I have a question for John.
All right.
My family home was in Falls Church, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., on the way to Langley. I had an elder gentleman who was a neighbor, fascinating neighbor, who wrote a book called The OSS and I, describing his journey with the OSS beginning in 1940 as a PhD in psychology, helping to screen many of the applicants from around the Allied forces at that time. And he was with that organization until 1950, by which time it had morphed into the CIA. he had me to understand, gave me to understand that the intelligence community, the international community of intelligence, was quite a bit like the National Football League, in that the basic primary allegiances and rules by which they were playing, the allegiances were to the league first and then to a nation secondarily, maybe. Would you consider that, John, to be a valid assessment then and or today?
Yes, I think that's a very interesting and a very good question. You know, the OSS's nickname in Britain was Oh So Social, because it was consisted originally of some very, very intelligent, very clever American elite people who come in. But their allegiance was primarily to the establishment and the organization first. And part of the reason of that comes back to what we said right at the start of the program, that this competitive business between the U.S. agencies, who want more budget, more power, so they're always fighting like cats in a sack to try and get the president's ear. And the minute the CIA comes in, we find that the CIA, that's where their loyalties lie if you're in the CIA. And if you're in the NSA, then your loyalties lie to Fort Meade. And very often the twain shall never meet.
You know, when you look at this planet today, John, and everything that is topsy-turvy, do you think we should go back about 30 years when we didn't have all this technology and stuff? Things seemed a little simpler then. I remember it.
Well, I think my great-uncle left the British Army because the country was going to the dogs back in 1930.
Huh.
Everybody looks back like that. And, of course, the one constant in life, as you and I know and our listeners know, the one constant is change, and we have to go with the change, like it or not, because you can't roll the years back.
No, you can't, and you have to adapt. That's the other thing.
And when you're my age and you're struggling with computers and mobile phones and this and that and every technical
device. How old are you?
Sorry?
How old are you?
I'm frightfully very, very old, you know. I'm 72.
Well, that's not very old nowadays. Your voice is very young.
Well, tell that to my knees, which are pretty young.
Let's go to Gil in Los Angeles, first-time caller. Hi, Gil. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Speaking of Orwell, he wrote a real good book in 1956. He fought in the Spanish Civil War. It's a very nice book, and he exposes the Soviet Union there for the first time.
And who was the author? Because you were breaking up a little bit there.
George Orwell.
Ah, okay. What do we know about that, John?
Well, he was a convinced socialist, and he's a very idealistic man, and he goes off and fights in the Spanish Civil War. And he's so appalled by what he sees with the old NKVD, the Russian secret police, trying to interfere in the Spanish Civil War, that he comes back a very disillusioned man. But he went there as part of the International Brigade, and he does his bit for socialism.
Do you see, John, in the not-too-distant future, some kind of nuclear altercation with either China or Russia or Iran or somebody?
I think that's an apocalyptic question in many ways. And, of course, the answer is it would be foolish to say no, because if there is something there, the chances are it's going to happen. Now, I do actually believe that the original signatories to the nuclear game, the superpowers, if you like, I don't have any problems there unless someone does something bloody stupid, and that's not going to happen. Ooh. But the people that worry me are the Iranians
and the
North Koreans,
yes.
And you've got a real problem there in America, and it's a terrible, terrible problem for American politicians. Maybe you should have done, when I say you, I don't mean that in a personal sense, but maybe the United States should have acted more decisively to stop this rot before it goes too far. Now we've got a problem, the world has got a problem, and containing it by putting a few missiles around to shoot down North Korea's missiles is merely an admission that they're going to have a nuclear missile eventually, which is what Kim Jong-un wants.
How we let that happen is beyond me.
Well, if there's a vacuum in diplomatic and foreign affairs, someone will ride into the gap.
Yeah.
And for the last 8 years, I hate to say this, America has decided it doesn't want to be the world's policeman. It's pulled back, and the bad guys have moved in.
And the problem is the guy, North Korean Kim Jong-un, is insane.
Well, he certainly appears that way, but I think he's a very calculated...
I mean, you fall asleep at one of his meetings, he kills you.
Yeah, because he wants to show who's top dog, and he kills you in a very unpleasant way. He lines you up with an anti-aircraft gun 100 yards away and blows you to bits.
No. Is that how he does it?
Oh, yes. He executed two people on a firing range last year, and they were tied to a post, and a 35 millimeter anti-aircraft gun was lined up and blew them apart.
Well, now, you'd know that there's got to be coup talk within his military. They want to take over and get him out. They have to.
Well, they've tried this in the past, haven't they? I mean, he seems to be a dictator in power. I always compare him with the Roman Emperor Caligula, who went mad in the end. Unfortunately, he's no Caligula, and he does have nuclear weapons, or he'll have them soon.
Well, he's got the nuclear weapons. He just doesn't have the full capability of getting them here yet, but he will have that soon.
So the question for our politicians and these people who want to be in charge of the world, what are you going to do about it?
See, and that's a decision, I think, between the United States, Russia, and China. And
I agree.
And all three of us need to come to the same conclusion and stop this.
That's a very good point, and I go along with that. Of course, at the moment, the fly in the ointment is China, because they're the ones who are kind of protecting North Korea. But over the last year, we've seen a shift.
Yes.
And Beijing is not happy with Kim Jong-un.
Jacob in San Jose, California is with us now. Hi, Jacob. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Wilson, back in 1980, President Carter was trying to get reelected, and the Republicans had the apparent help of Israel and factions in the Central Intelligence Agency that seemed to control a merchant vessel, the SS Poet, a very long ship that was used to carry military goods to Iran, so they would hold the hostages until after the 1980 election, because the government of Israel perceived Carter as an existential threat. Do you believe that the SS Poet and their crew were sunk because they were witnesses to treason?
No, I think that you've hit on a very important question, though, Jacob, and it was a very... We talk about meddling in other people's affairs and how the Russians are supposed to have done it over your recent election. I think the same thing can be pointed very firmly at Israel and its friends in the United States who have interfered greatly in these things as we go along. And there's no doubt in my mind that the debacle of that in the desert at the end of Carter's presidency, it was absolutely shocking because the deal was already on the table that once the next president got in, everything was going to be hunky-dory, and that's what happened.
Let's go next to, thank you, Jake, appreciate it, Paul in Albany, New York now. Hi, Paul, go ahead.
Hi, George. What a fascinating interview you've got there. I want to ask Mr. Wilson, is it?
Yes.
John Hughes Wilson. In terms of their international responsibilities, just what is the difference between MI5 and MI6? I'm
very straightforward, Paul. I can answer that very quickly. MI5 is the domestic security agency. The nearest equivalent would be the feds, the FBI, the Phoebes. And MI6 is the Secret Intelligence Service, which is Britain's overseas spying arm and collects international intelligence. The security service is totally constrained by law on UK domestic property and UK crown properties. MI6 oversees, under the Intelligence Services Act of 1974, Paul, they can do things that would not be allowed inside continental USA or inside Great Britain.
And get away with it.
I couldn't possibly comment, sir.
Uh-huh. You just did. Joe in Columbus, Ohio. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a part of the great game. I'm an ex-military intelligence officer, and I was a few times on the wrong end of 122-millimeter rockets. I have several comments to make and then a question. I think the thing about being the world's policeman for the last 8 years, it occurs to me that in this country, the money that it would have taken to do some of those things, I think the wealthy did not want to be taxed any more than they were. And the middle class people simply could not afford to be taxed any more than they were. The second thing is regarding foreign, let's say, friendly countries passing information on to them. I think people need to know that when somebody is passing information, he or she cannot be absolutely sure that he or she is passing it on to whom he thinks he or she is passing it to. As an example, we had Pollard, and Pollard was passing information to the Israelis, and yep. He really was, okay? Yep. But for all he knew, he might have been passing it on to somebody who was posing as an Israeli and sending it on to whomever,
right.
Russia, Iran,
exactly.
or anybody like that. The third thing is when it comes to signals intelligence, I've always been interested in that field and the cryptography and so on, which brings me to a case that happened in UK maybe 3 or 4 years ago. There was a cryptographer who died under extremely mysterious circumstances. He was found bound and gagged and locked up and drowned and everything in a bathtub.
And well, they probably called it suicide, right?
Yes. And I thought, really?
Interesting take. Only got 40 seconds left, John. Why don't you give us a wrap-up of what the world can expect over the next 4 years?
Nothing but trouble. Nothing but trouble, and the problem is going to be, who is going to make the first move to stop it, or is the world going to go to hell in a handcart?
So our new president is going to have a lot on his plate.
Who'd want to be president of the United States of America?
Well, it's a tough job, to be sure. John, thank you so much. John Hughes Wilson. His website doesn't have one, but his books, The Secret State, The Puppet Masters, and JFK, An American Coup d'Etat. Invited back anytime you want, John. Up next, I've got 2 hours of open lines for you, and we'll also take your texts and tweets right here on Coast to Coast AM. So get ready for 2 hours of open lines.